Ele toledot Noach. Noach ish tzadik tamim haya bedorotav et hoelokim hithalech Noach. OU Israel presents
in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, one of the first of 5772. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Noach, which coincides this year with Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan. In fact, recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday afternoon, the eve of Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan. Today's date would be the 29th, of Mar Cheshvan, 5772, and in the secular calendar, it is October 27th. In a short while from now, evening will come, and it will be the first of 2 days of Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan. Since Tishrei always has 30 days in our fixed calendar, Mar Cheshvan always has 2 days Rosh Chodesh. This year's configuration of Friday and Shabbat for Rosh Chodesh is the most common and occurs a little over 31%, actually close to 32% of the time. And that's not a big deal, but that's the fact. Parshat Noach occurs once a year, and we will talk about mostly Parshat Noach. Before that, since we are not yet saying Tachanun, according to the common minhag in Eretz Yisrael, not to say Tachanun until after Yom Kippur, all the way through Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan, we will do Tehillim Kuf Kaf Aleph, Psalm 121. Shir Lama Alot, Esa Einai El Heharim Me'ayin Yavo Ezri. Ezri me'im Adonai osei shamayim va'aretz. Al yitain lamot raglecha, al yanum shomerecha. Hine lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomerecha, Adonai tzilecha al yad yeminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka v'yoreach balayla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor tzeitecha uvoecha me'ata v'ad olam. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem viyotziyem, mitzara lirvacha umeafela laora, umishibud lgeula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, vinomar amen. For those who understood the last part of this prayer, it has a special meaning now that Gilad Shalit has been released from captivity after 5.5 years. I am not going to discuss whether the price of his release was too high or not. It's something I wrote about on the one hand, on the other hand, in Torah Tidbits this week. But let's leave it as may God have mercy on them and bring them from difficulty to comfort, from darkness to light, from oppression to redemption, speedily in our time, and may this be so, at less cost, but in good health to other captives, and that includes the quick release, can't really use that term quick now, the quick release of Jonathan Pollard from prison. He should never have been imprisoned in the first place, and certainly has served way, way, way more time than he should have, even in the strictest and most negative interpretation of what he did and what he caused. and especially since he was promised things if he were to confess and plead guilty, which he accepted, and he did, and then all the offers and deals were reneged upon. So he really shouldn't be there, and we should keep him in our prayers every time we say, Achinu Kol Beit Yisrael, our brothers, all the house of Israel, who find themselves in difficulties and in captivity. So we are happy for Gilad Shalit and his family, and we hope to be happy with the release of Jonathan Pollard, as well as others whose fates still await God's hand and human help. The first part of Parshat Noach, the main part of Parshat Noach, deals with Noach and the Teva, Noah and the Ark, the Flood, and all things related to it. On a, nostalgic and humorous note, I always think of, can't help it, the Bill Cosby routine, Noah and the Lord. I heard it presented as a skit between two people, with two people, in Bnei Akiva many, many, many years ago. Didn't know that it was Bill Cosby's till later. I'm not going to play the whole thing. I want to play a first clip which will set the tone. It's close to the beginning of the routine. And then I'll make a comment and I'll play another clip which we will then discuss.
Who is that?
It's the Lord, Noah.
Right. Where I am. What do you want? I've been good.
I want you to build an ark.
Right. What's an ark?
Get some wood, build it 300 cubits by 80 cubits by 40 cubits.
Right. What's a cubit?
Well, don't worry about that, Noah. When you get that done, go out into the world, collect all of the animals in the world by twos, male and female, and put them into the ark.
Right.
I debated putting on the whole thing, but I'm not going to do it. For those who know the routine, they could just smile at it and find it on the internet on their own. For those who don't, look for it, Cosby, Noah, and the Lord. It's a very amusing routine back in his stand-up comic days. But there's a little piece now where he's finishing his tasks. He's taking the last pairs of animals onto the ark. He mentions the difficulty he had distinguishing between male and female mosquitoes, restricting the rabbits to only two, and now he is pushing on the two hippopotamuses when he hears the voice of God.
Come on, fat hippos, hurry up. Come on, will you please?
Noah.
What? What do you want?
Gotta take one of those hippos out and bring in another one.
What for?
Because you got two males down there and you need to bring in a female.
I'm not bringing nothing in. You change one of them.
Come on, you know I don't work like that.
Come on, you know I don't work like that. I don't know how many times I heard this routine all those many years ago, until that line clicked as being not only funny in the context of the skit, it is, I believe, very profound. And I've always wondered, I've never bothered trying to contact Bill Cosby, but I always wondered if he was the one who wrote this routine, if he thought of it in a theological way. What we have in Parshat Noach, at the beginning, is God's command to Noach to build the Teva. He's told, not like the dimensions that Bill Cosby uses, that it should be 300 amot by 50 amot by 30 amot. You want to get an approximate idea in meters, you just drop it in half. 150 meters long, 25 meters wide, 15 meters high, three stories. And he's told to bring in two of each animal, seven pairs of all the kosher animals, food for his family and all the animals on the ark for a year. And whenever anyone has attempted to calculate how much food and other things about the practical side of what Noah's tasks were, they come to the conclusion that there's something off. There's no way, and many of our commentaries point this out, there is no way that this could be done in a natural manner. There's not enough room on the ark, and everything about it is totally unnatural. Animals that are not compatible with each other, that require different climates and different living conditions and different foods, and they would eat each other, and what about reproduction? And what we know is that the entire year's experience of the flood for those aboard the Teva, the Ark, was, I like to call it, something akin to suspended animation. It was not meaning suspension of nature. Nothing followed the laws of nature. Animals didn't eat and sleep and live like they usually did. Neither did Noah and his family. It was a totally supernatural, unnatural period of time. So the question that the commentaries ask is, what's the significance of telling us that God commanded that the ark be 300 amot by 50 amot by 30 amot and all the other details if miracle is involved? To put it differently, if we're talking about God's miracles, then I have a better idea, I say facetiously. Let God snap his divine finger, let the entire world be destroyed, and let only Noah, his wife, his three sons and their wives, and pairs of all the animals and 14 of all the kosher animals survive. God is capable of doing that also. But the point is, as presented by Bill Cosby, come on, you know I don't work like that. That was God's comment to the Bill Cosby version of Noah, who said, if I have two males hippopotamuses that I brought on board, then change one of them. And God is certainly capable of doing that. We don't question his ability. But the fact of the matter is, he chooses not to work that way. He chose, in this case, and you could look at any miracle recorded in Tanakh and discuss it in a similar way. In this case, he chose to command Noah to build an ark. He gave him dimensions of the ark, which would keep him busy, which would become known to the people who lived in his community and in his part of the world, and they would ask him what he's doing, and he would tell him what he was doing, and according to our tradition, it was a process of 120 years from the time he was commanded to build the ark and take the animals on board until the actual flood began. So there was plenty of time for human involvement, for human notification, and the ability of the people to take what Noah was telling them seriously and perhaps repent and change their ways. So we're dealing here with a combination of things. I like to describe it like this. A miracle that is 100% supernatural is dazzling and awe-inspiring, and we shrug our shoulders when we begin to think about what just happened or how it happened. We get a headache, and I believe we don't properly relate to the miracles. When we participate, or when we are told of human participation, and then the helping hand of God in some proportion or another, we have a better handle on understanding and appreciating a miracle. I want to give you an analogy, and I don't want you to think that I am demeaning the concept of miracles and just talking about them as if they were magic tricks. But that's my analogy. When I saw a TV presentation by Copperfield of making an elephant to disappear, it was so well done that I was impressed, but shrugged my shoulders and did not really appreciate the quality of the trick, because I had no idea, no clue as to what was involved. When I saw a much simpler trick of a magician, the ones where he puts a ball between his pinky and his ring finger, and then flash, there are two of them, and flash, there are three of them, and then there are four of them between all the fingers, and then they disappear, 3, 2, 1. When I saw how that was done, and then I saw the performance of that trick again, even though it can't compare to the disappearance of an elephant or the Statue of Liberty or whatever, but I was impressed with it. And I was impressed when it was done again after I knew the mechanics of the trick. I found it more impressive. To me, this is an analogy, albeit with the warning that I gave before not to misunderstand my choice of the analogy, to when God brings in human participation into a process which is miraculous, then we are capable of relating to it, learning from it, and it has a long-term effect on us more than the flash-in-the-pan, showy miracle that are without human involvement. I believe that the Six-Day War, the raid at Entebbe, were totally miraculous events with a heavy hand of God involved. But the beauty of it was all of the human hishtadlus. Hishtadlus means effort. And the word is really hishtadlut, but you can't say it that way. You have to say hishtadlus, which is the yeshivish, yiddishy way of saying the word. But it means we have to be involved. Noach had to be involved in saving himself and his family, even if he couldn't do it by himself. He had to sweat and work hard, and then God would be ready to help him. So in the Cosby routine, when he brings in two males, he has to go through the difficulty of taking one hippopotamus out and bringing in another, a female, if that's what happened, or certainly in this presentation. And not, even though God is capable of changing it, that's not the way he works. My mind wanders to different things. Just one more example. The woman who came to Elisha the prophet and was destitute and in fear of her son being taken from her. And he said, "What do you got in the house?" And she said, "I have a little bit of oil." And he said, "Okay, borrow as many vessels as you can and put a drop of oil, smear of oil in each of them until you run out of vessels or the little bit of oil that you have." Miraculously, all the vessels then filled to the brim, and the woman was able to go into the olive oil business and sustain her family. Why not what was the need to, that she had a little bit of oil and that she had to borrow vessels? If God can miraculously make oil increase, he could make oil appear. If he could fill vessels with oil, he could present filled vessels. But he doesn't work like that. There has to be some anchoring, maybe that's the right word that I'm looking for, of a miracle in nature. That leads me to something else, which I wasn't going to get to yet, but let's take it that way. The rainbow. The rainbow, I'm just looking at it from one angle at the moment, is a natural phenomenon that is nonetheless miraculous. The rainbow, according to our tradition, was one of the items created in the moment before the very first Shabbat of creation. And even though there is a physical explanation to a rainbow, it is nonetheless a miracle of nature. In fact, all of nature is miraculous. And the only difference between a quote, well-known miracle and the everyday miracles of nature is that everyday things tend to be taken for granted. But they're no less miraculous. This leads me to something I've mentioned in the show in the past, many times more than once, to a statement from Anton Chekhov's The Bet, where he states that the problem with human beings is that they would be amazed if an apple tree bore frogs, but they're not amazed that an apple tree bears apples. That an apple tree bears apples is a phenomenal miracle. It's a wondrous miracle. We just take it for granted. And the challenge of the Jew, of Judaism, is not to take things for granted. We will return shortly, Emir Tzashem, with more Torah Tidbits audio. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Noach and Rosh Chodesh. In a couple of hours, I will be heading out to Hebron to an engagement party for my nephew, Yisrael Aryeh, to Ruti Wilder, and in his honor and their honor, I would like to play a song which I happen to love. The text is taken from the meditation or the recitation that some people use before they put on their talit. When he gets married, he'll be wearing a talit. That's my connection, but I happen to like the song also. And it's about divine protection. It's a nice, mellow song. I hope you enjoy it, and it penetrates beyond the listening experience into the heart and the soul. Tinatzel nafshi.
תנצל נפשי לרוחי ונשמתי ותפילתי מן החיצוני תנצל נפשי לרוחי ונשמתי ותפילתי מן החיצוני נשמעתי ותפילתי מן
At the beginning of Parshat Noach, Noach is described by the Torah as Ish Tzadik, a righteous person, Tamim Haya Bidorotav. Excuse me, he was pure in his generation. Tzadik Tamim, a pure Tzadik, a pure righteous person. Rashi, major commentary on the Torah, discusses two different opinions that have been around for a very long time. One says that the Bidorotav in his generation is meant to limit the impression of his being an Ish Tzadik Tamim by saying in his generation, a totally wicked generation with all kind of perversities and sins, so a regular guy could come across like a righteous person. The other opinion is, even in such a generation, he was a tzaddik. Imagine how much of a righteous person he would be in a regular generation. It's a matter of which way you look at it. And we look at it both ways. It always used to bother me why there was an opinion interpreting it in a negative way, when we are supposed to give the benefit of the doubt and say the Torah calls him an Ish Tzadik Tamim in his generation. Give it the positive spin. Why the negative spin? And why a dispute? And why leave it as a dispute? Now, that's a good question altogether. I don't have a great answer. I have an idea that, first of all, our sages were being as honest as they could, showing two possible interpretations, not knowing which one it is. By the way, when we compare Noach in his generation to Avraham Avinu in his generation, and the results of their lives, Avraham comes out on a much higher level than Noach does. Yet Noach was one of the teachers of Avraham Avinu, and I am always struck every Rosh Hashanah when we say in the Zichronot, the Bracha of Remembrances, where Noach is treated very specially in that Bracha, and there is just the quoting of a verse about our ancestors in Egypt and about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But the text of the blessing, the introduction to the bracha, focuses on God's mercy and love of Noach, which, I'll stay in this by the way mode for a moment, tells us something about all the people of the world. We consider all the people of the world who are not Jewish to be B'nai Noach. B'nai Noach has a narrower interpretation of those who follow the mitzvot of B'nai Noach, but B'nai Noach is a generic term for human beings. And they have their place in this world. The fact that the Torah begins with the Sedra of Bereshit and the Sedra of Noach, before we get to Avraham, our own origins as Jews at the very end of Noach and into Lech Lecha and Vayera and Chayei Sarah. People, all people, are created in God's image, have a value. We believe that we have taken upon ourselves, that's not really a good term, we have been presented with a challenge that goes beyond that which God expects from regular human beings, but there are expectations from human beings. You're not an animal. You're a person. A person has free will, has accountability for what he does, and has, in our view, certain responsibilities for this world. And this is a point to dwell upon, at least until next week's Torah reading of Lech Lecha, when we get more into the background and the history of the Jewish family, which became the Jewish nation, ultimately. I don't know if this is going to be so accurate, but another way we could look at it, I shouldn't have introduced it in that negative way, this is a thought that I would like to express. The fact of the matter is, God, according to the Torah, was displeased with the people of the world and brought about almost total annihilation of the entire population of the world, human and animal, with the exception of those that survived on the Teva. 10 generations later, which was a shorter period of time according to the chronology, God was again frustrated and angry, so to speak, with the people of the world. And it does not tell us, because it didn't happen this way, it does not tell us that God destroyed most of the world again and kept Avraham and his family alive to become what? The Jewish people. The Jewish people make up a pitifully small percentage of the world population. And we consider Avraham and Sarah to be the patriarchs and matriarchs of many, many nations, even though we take them to ourselves as our patriarch and matriarch, together with Yitzchak and Rivka and Yaakov and Rachel and Leah. But the fact that the world has reached or is about to reach 7 billion people, where the total population of Jews in this world maybe is 14 million, and 14 million is 2/1 of the world population. That's 1/5%, if I remember my arithmetic. 1/5% of the world population is Jewish. By the numbers, we have to say and we have to agree that there is a value to the entire human population of the world. So Judaism does not dismiss the nations of the world. In fact, we believe in a Noahide code of 7 mitzvah categories, which really are many, many more mitzvot than 7, over 70, and a whole bunch of others which we feel are incumbent upon all human beings in the world. And not more than that, but that's enough. Very much common these days is when a non-Jew approaches Jews to convert to Judaism, in addition to our long-standing policy of trying to discourage it in order to feel whether the person is really sincere or not, is to recommend that they pursue the 7 Noahide laws, not just as abstract, but as concrete mitzvot, to be performed and observed, l'shem Hashem Elokei Yisrael, for the sake of the God of Israel. And there are yeshivot around the world which teach prospective righteous b'nei Noach all the requirements that from the perspective of Judaism all people are supposed to follow. If a non-Jew wants to pursue that, he does not have to fast on Yom Kippur. He does not have to keep kosher. These are not things that are necessary for being a good human being. These are requirements for being a good Jew. There's a different understanding of as to how this works. But there are basic requirements of humanity, which all people of the world, including Jews, of course, need to live up to and need to understand. Again, a side point, a Jew has to know what are the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach so that in his interaction with the non-Jewish world, he will not be put into a position where he will become a stumbling block before the blind, as the expression goes, not just for a fellow Jew and what he's obligated to do, but a non-Jew and what he's obligated to do. Now, obviously, we don't have any jurisdiction over the non-Jews of the world, even when we had the total justice infrastructure in Israel of a Sanhedrin and everything that goes along with it. We would then have only control over the behavior of people who live in Israel. Outside of Israel, we can teach, we can show people how we believe they're supposed to behave, but there is no jurisdiction. On the other hand, we need to assume that role which we are supposed to assume, and that of being a light unto the nations, to teach basic, decent human behavior and moral code. Back to the previous thought, even though the book of the Torah is essentially for us a guideline for our Jewish life, the fact that in Parshat Noach we have detailed namings of the 70 nations of the world, which of course now have proliferated into over 200, but all of this material you can shrug and say, what does the Torah have to tell me this? What do I have to know about all of these names of the children of Shem, Ham, and Yefet? The only ones that we should be interested in are Shem and the descent which leads to Avraham and from there on? And the answer is no. We're interested in all of this. We are members of the human race. We have 7 billion people we share this planet with, and we have mutual responsibilities, etc., etc. Now, towards the end of the Sedra, we have the episode of the Tower of Babel, which is interesting in its contrast to the bulk of Parshat Noach, the flood. Here's a situation where people banded together in order to rebel against God, and they were thwarted, but they were not destroyed. As opposed to the corruption that's described at the beginning of the Sedra, which led to the actual destruction of everyone except for those who were in the Teva. And commentaries point out that when people are basically decent human beings and they rebel against God, God can take care of himself. And if he chose to disperse them and to mix up their languages without the necessity of destroying them, that's what he did. But that first generation of the flood could not be allowed to survive because their corruption included the total decay and destruction of society. And then there's no basis on which they can continue to survive, to exist. On that note, let's go back a step to the fact that God made a promise not to destroy the entire world as he had done. And that was in recognition of human nature. Of course, all of this needs to be said kivyochol, meaning so to speak, speaking of God with human terms, which is about the only thing we're capable of doing anyway. And we use the expression God getting angry. He doesn't get angry. He doesn't have emotions like we do. And yet we perceive, we project our emotions on him in order to understand the interaction of God with this world. So I'm not suggesting that that God got angry, that he forgot what he did, that he got disappointed. I believe all of this is presented in the Torah to impress upon us the process. The world came into existence in stages, and that first form that the world took after the 6 days of creation corrupted to the point where it was mostly destroyed and reshaped and restructured and started again. And that's the value which we need to place in this world that we lived in, not as a careless act of God's, but as a thought-out process and a layered kind of creation. And it is all meant to increase the meaningfulness of our own lives. Abruptly changing, let me spend a few minutes on Rosh Chodesh, especially Mar Cheshvan. The last Rosh Chodesh was that of Tishrei, which sort of gets very much eclipsed by it being Rosh Hashanah. There's hardly a mention of it being Rosh Chodesh, the first real month we could speak about after this holiday-filled month of Tishrei, is Mar Cheshvan. First of all, let me say something about its name. I have in the past referred to it as Cheshvan, which a lot of people do, and that was with the understanding that the name Mar Cheshvan was a combination of the word Mar, meaning bitter, or maybe meaning mister, or whatever, and Cheshvan, whatever that means. It has come to my attention that that's not the case. The name is Mar Cheshvan. It's a Babylonian name, like many of the other months are named, and does not split between Mar and Cheshvan, and there really is no name of a month Cheshvan. Sure enough, I did a computer search on the entire Talmud and found the name Mar Cheshvan repeatedly, did never find Cheshvan by itself. I went through Rambam, Maimonides, his code, only Mar Cheshvan, no Cheshvan, and all of Rashi on the Talmud, and no mention of the name Cheshvan. It appears that it's a much later kind of thing, and it could be that it creeped into our vocabulary by mistake. So I am trying always to refer to it as Mar Cheshvan, even though it makes the spelling of the month a little longer than it should be. Mar Cheshvan is a month that is associated with rain. Interesting in its contrast between the episode of the flood, which is excessive water destruction, to our beginning the prayer for rain next Thursday evening. We'll talk more about it, Mir Tzashem, next week, where we in Israel start asking for Talu Matar, for blessed, beneficial rain. The flood is described as having started on the 17th of the second month, which according to the Tishrei Cheshvan counting is Mar Cheshvan. There I slipped and I said Cheshvan. And the flood ended a year plus later on the 27th of the second month, Mar Cheshvan. So in the month of Mar Cheshvan, you have the prayer for blessed rain. You have the reminder with Parshat Noach and with the chronology of the flood, the reminder of destructive rain. And so what we want from God is blessed rain. On that note, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, Lehishtameah.